The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's really hard to conduct attacks against U.S. military personnel because these militias would have to attack Iraqi bases and potentially incur Iraqi casualties in an attack on American forces. It would be easier to go after our embassy in Baghdad or our consulate in Erbil, where you can be much more assured that you will be targeting Americans and not targeting others. This is what I fear, is that some group, probably one that is not directly under the control of Iran, might feel that they want to make a name for themselves by being the one that pushes the Americans out by increasing casualties. And that's one of the fears that I see in Iraq. Otherwise, I suspect that there will be a further entrenching in the population of this attitude that neither the United States nor Iran really has Iraq's interests at heart, and we are just fighting over Iraq, not to the benefit of Iraqis. And I would not like to see that continue.
I'm Scott R. Anderson, and this is the Lawfare Podcast for July 30th, 2019. Few nations have a history with the United States that is as complicated as that of the Republic of Iraq. Today, several factors, including the Trump administration's campaign of maximum pressure against Iraq's neighbor Iran, are putting entirely new pressures on this relationship, one that many believe remains essential to maintaining regional security, even if it is rarely featured on front pages. To help examine these dynamics and what they might mean, I spoke to someone who knows the relationship between Iraq and the United States like few others, Ambassador Doug Silliman, the new president of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, who from 2016 until earlier this year served as the United States ambassador in Baghdad. As a career diplomat who spent 35 years in the Foreign Service, Ambassador Silliman brings a wealth of experience to his understanding of the issues, including as my boss during my own time as a government lawyer in Baghdad. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 439. Ambassador Doug Silliman on the state of the U.S.-Iraq relationship. So, Ambassador, your tenure as ambassador, first in Kuwait, first in Iraq, really spanned this transition period between the Obama administration and the Trump administration, both of which came to the Middle East with a particular set of perspectives, views, assumptions, a kind of baggage. What was that sort of baggage, and how did that transition navigate from those two different perspectives they brought to the region?
Well, Scott, I think that the biggest difference is probably the attitude of the two administrations toward Iran. In President Obama's initial inaugural address, he said that he would reach out a hand to anyone who would unclench their fist, which was at the time broadly interpreted as an offering of peace to Iran, which ultimately was made concrete in the very long and detailed negotiations of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal. There was an attempt inside the Obama administration to find areas, particularly working with our close European allies, where we could make concrete progress. For the Trump administration, there was much more concern that what the Obama administration and previous administrations had done was inadequate for the needs of the United States. So in the Trump administration, we were seeking to not to parrot the president, but get a better deal, to find a deal that went beyond the JCPOA by including for the Iranians a cessation of their support to revolutionary destabilizing groups in the region, an end to their ballistic missile program, in addition to the limitations on the nuclear program that had come through the JCPOA. So the very significant different approaches of the two administrations to Iran affected what we did in the region.
And you were seeing these changes specifically from Baghdad. I mean, what does that sort of shift in perspective mean for the U.S. relationship with Iraq, which obviously borders and has a close relationship with Iran?
Frankly, the first impact that we saw of the Trump administration in Baghdad wasn't really in relation to Iran. It was the very early inclusion of Iraq in the what has been called Muslim visa ban that was instituted in the second week of the administration, followed very shortly afterwards in March by a visit of the Iraqi prime minister, at that point Haider al-Abadi, to Washington and meetings with the president in the White House. So, if you will, sort of contradictory messages, but nonetheless, the initial impact of Trump administration policies on Iraq had nothing to do with Iran, even despite my earlier statement. But it was a desire by the president to figure out why we were in Iraq. What benefits had we gotten? What resources had we spent in Iraq over the course of the period since 2003? And what policies should the administration pursue to get a better deal from Iraq or a better deal on Iraq?
So, you know, the Trump administration went through this period where it's looking at this sort of relationship, doing these sorts of evaluations. Where do you feel like it landed on that? Well, how does the Trump administration think about and view the relationship with Iraq?
I'm actually pleased with where the Trump administration has landed. When President Trump visited Iraq on the day after Christmas last year in 2018, I wasn't entirely sure what his attitude was toward a long-term American diplomatic or military presence inside Iraq. And I came away after the conversations I had with the president on that day and that visit convinced that he thought that the investment that the United States had already made in Iraq from 2003 required a bit of staying power. And the material and personnel losses in Iraq meant that we were really there for the long term. I got the impression that he wanted it to turn out well and turn out right in terms of U.S. interests. I can't really define specifically what that was in terms of specific policy outcomes, but I felt that the president was committed to continuing a policy of engagement in Iraq.
Now, during your time in Iraq, you were there during a lot of highs and lows. You came on shortly before, at least a few months before, kind of the end of the territorial campaign against ISIS in Iraq that continued obviously a bit longer in Syria. But most of the military operations in Iraq wound up around 2017, early 2017, I believe. But then we saw quickly a conflict break out between our central government in Baghdad and its Iraqi Kurdish region. Then we saw a very controversial election. Where is this left kind of the Iraqi state and the Iraqi government? How has those developments impacted our relationship in ways that we expected and may not have expected?
That's a very interesting question. And all of the things that you mentioned had different impacts. First of all, the very strong role of the United States and the international coalition in defeating ISIS militarily in Iraq created a good impression on the part of or in the minds of most Iraqis. Most Iraqis credit the United States with helping the Iraqi military push ISIS out of the country. So that was a very positive impact. And I think it has led to a larger number of Iraqis understanding that a strong relationship with the United States is good for Iraq in the long term. The question of the Kurdistan independence referendum that you mentioned, I think was probably ill-advised on the part of the Kurdistan government to conduct, not necessarily because conducting a referendum was a bad idea, but the way in which it was conducted, which included areas that were disputed, the control of which is disputed between the government in Baghdad and the government in Erbil, made it appear to many Iraqis, many Arab Iraqis, that Kurds were trying to take part of Iraqi territory back from Iraq. And that caused a great deal of consternation. We advised the Kurds repeatedly in conjunction with the United Kingdom, the United Nations, and pretty much all of our allies that we thought it was a bad idea that would probably not help the cause of Kurdish independence, nor would it help the cause of improving the relationship between Erbil and Baghdad. But the Kurdistan government went ahead with the referendum despite the nearly universal international concerns about it. The elections in 2018 were actually very interesting because they have produced a very strange bifurcated government. In conversations with the Iraqis that I have had over the past 10 years, I've spent five of my last 10 years in Iraq and have talked to a lot of Iraqis. A lot of Iraqis, probably a significant majority, supports the idea of democracy, democratic elections, and the right and the ability of Iraqis to choose their own government from the local level to the provincial level up to the national level. What happened in the 2018 elections was unfortunate in that the turnout was very, very low. I did observation of the elections in a couple of neighborhoods in Baghdad, and near the end of the day, the highest voting percentage of any polling place that I visited was 22% of registered voters. And when you have a turnout that is that low, it is the most organized political parties, the most organized non-official political groups, the ones who are able to get their supporters to the polls that come out on top. So in the Kurdistan region, you saw the better organized political parties come again with the dominant political position in the parliament from the Kurdish side. You saw in the Arab part of Iraq an increase in the representation of militias, people who had an organized political cadre who they could get to the polls, and a lot of Iraqis who just weren't quite sure about what the elections meant or where the country was going simply stayed home. What is sort of ironic is that the Iraqi army did a spectacular job in protecting Iraqi voting places. There was not a single significant incidence of violence on the day of the elections. But perhaps because there was a fear of that or a fear of the outcome was determined and seems to have gone in favor of traditional organized political parties or militias who were able to get their cadre to the polls. So what you have now is a government that is kind of split. You have a government under Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mehdi, about half of which is actually a quite good government. Many of them were actually ministers in the 2004-2005 government and have come back. Many of them have held significant positions in international organizations or in the private sector either before 2003 or since 2003. And there has been a push to reach out to the world. The foreign minister worked for a long time at the United Nations. The Minister of Health worked at the World Health Organization. And there are several other examples of very professional, experienced, worldly Iraqis who are now back running their institutions. For the other side of the scale that was determined mostly by those who supported militias or were more supportive of Iran, there was a desire by each party to get their fair share. And there's been a struggle among some of the parties over the distribution of seats, I think more as a spoil system than as an attempt to, you know, make the country better for the future or to better represent Iraq. So you have half of a government which is actually quite good and half of a government where I am somewhat suspicious of the origins because it came out of political wrangling. That said, it's probably the best, most forward-looking and most outward-looking Iraqi government since 2004. And that means that there are opportunities to deal with the government and hopefully accomplish some concrete things.
Now, what has that kind of political transition that you discussed meant for, I guess, engagement with the United States? Now, certain types of engagement with the United States have always been controversial. Military presence has historically been controversial, although, as you noted, the ISIS campaign has brought at least some accommodation, some understanding about that a little bit more in part to the Iraqi populace. But, you know, the new government is representing a little different constituency to some extent. It's got new political figures. Has there been changes in the dialogue and discussion around the U.S.-Iraqi relationship arising from that? Or has there been an effort to maintain and secure the kind of strong relationship that they've been developed to the extent possible?
I think a little bit of both. Again, the electorate is split on the idea of foreign influences and foreign connections inside Iraq. Many Iraqis, I think incorrectly, see Iraq now caught in a struggle between Iran on one side and the United States on the other. I always tried to define for Iraqis that it was really Iran on the one side and the international community on the other, given many of the peculiarities of the relationship between Iraq and Iran. But one thing that made me feel better in the past year is the number of Iraqi politicians, prominent Iraqis, who said publicly that Iraq needed to maintain a strong relationship with the United States, first for economic benefits. Iraqis, I think, understand that they will need to develop their private sector and make it much more robust for the economy to provide for jobs for the very large number of Iraqis graduating from secondary school and university every year. But more importantly, vocal public support for a continued coalition military presence, which is basically says the American military should remain here to help train the Iraqi security forces, to help instill in them the discipline and the ability to remain professional as they did during the fight against ISIS. This is something new. I was also in Iraq in 2011 during the Obama administration, during the discussions on the need to withdraw U.S. forces by the end of 2011, per the agreement that the Bush administration had made at the end of 2008. And while Senator John McCain famously said he never met an Iraqi who told him that the United States should leave, I never met an Iraqi who was willing to say that publicly. So you had a very bifurcated set of messages in 2011 with people saying, we need the United States military to stay here, but essentially with people saying, you need to stay here on your own terms so we can continue to call you occupiers. We don't want to embrace you as a partner. So the U.S. military departs. And at the end of 2017 and in 2018, that narrative has somewhat changed. There is now a significant part of the Iraqi political elite and a significant part of the Iraqi population that would like to see a continued U.S. military and coalition presence in Iraq. There's another half to the story. There are also significant numbers of Iraqis who are either Shia nationalists or supporters of Iran and want to see a closer relationship between Iran and Iraq. Many of those have been very vocal, including in the past few days, about their desire to see all U.S. forces depart the country, essentially saying, you helped us take care of ISIS. Thank you very much. The job is now done. So there's the door. You can leave anytime you want. And there is now some tension in Iraq in those two camps. I think that the maximum pressure campaign that the Trump administration is putting on Iran has put greater focus and probably given more energy to the camp that is saying that it's time for the American military to leave. And it may have somewhat quieted those who would like to see the United States stay, but that debate is still not yet completed. And most of the senior people in the government would like to see a continued American and coalition military presence for helping with the remnants of ISIS, but really for training the Iraqi military and the police and trying to instill in them the traditions that they need to maintain the professionalism that they developed during the fight against ISIS.
I want to come back to the maximum pressure campaign, but let me zoom in on two points of this I think are worth clarifying for folks. First one, I want to ask you a little bit about that. A lot of the dynamics we're discussing sound like they relate primarily to the Shia-dominated government and the factions there as well. How have U.S. relations with the Kurdish region, which was historically been very strong, shifted, been damaged by or perhaps recovered from the 2017 conflict where the U.S. position was controversial, particularly in the north parts of the country where the Kurdish region exists?
I think that there has been a continued very strong relationship between the United States and the Kurdistan region. And I will say that the Kurdistan region is by far the most supportive part of the country with regard to the continued presence of American and coalition military forces in the country. There are U.S. and coalition forces in many places in Iraq, but there are quite a few also up in the Kurdistan region. And the relationship with the Kurdish Peshmerga and with the government of the Kurdistan region has been very close, and they've been very supportive of the efforts to for those troops to stay in the country. I think, frankly, many Kurds were disappointed in the American reaction to the 2017 independence referendum. I think their political leadership mistakenly believed non-governmental voices in Washington and the United States that was encouraging them to move forward. And they did not want to listen to voices, my voice, but also voices in the administration in Washington that was advising them that we truly did not support the independence of Kurdistan for a variety of reasons that were beyond simply the borders of Iraq, a relationship with Syria, with Turkey, with Iran, and the difficulties that all of these countries have with their own Kurdish populations makes this a much more difficult issue than just independence or not independence for the Kurdish region of Iraq. So I think that the relationship has continued as a very strong one. I think probably now some Kurds have more doubts about continued American support for Kurdistan, but it hasn't really affected anything concrete that I was able to see while I was there.
And the other issue I want to push on a little more or clarify is this idea of what a U.S. military presence is and what that means exactly. You know, we've gone through different phases. There was a period where American forces really were manning security, actively pursuing counterterrorism targets. That faded for a long time, revived a little bit around the ISIS campaign, but even then primarily focused on training, advising, assisting, supporting Iraqi troops. What does it mean to say there's going to be an American or a coalition military presence in Iraq moving forward in the eyes of most Iraqis who have come around on that idea? You know, of course, we've had President Trump say at various points mention or allude the possibility of U.S. troops in Iraq being involved in counter-Iran activities or surveilling Iran. Is that a pressure point? Is that a challenge? And if so, what is the appropriate scope of activities for U.S. troops that are there in the eyes of Iraqis?
The first thing I think is that both Iraqis and Americans radically misunderstand the scale of a military presence that we are talking about. At the height of the surge in 2007, we had as many as 270,000 uniformed U.S. forces on the ground in Iraq. When I left Iraq, we were closer to 5,000. And the troops that are left in Iraq all reside on Iraqi bases or at the U.S. Embassy compound for the senior leadership. And they are engaged primarily in training the Iraqi military, the Iraqi counterterrorism service, and to a lesser extent, the Iraqi police in a variety of skills. They have also helped the Iraqis revamp the way that they do intelligence collection and analysis with a real focus on how to prevent the rise of an Al-Qaeda 3.0 in the western deserts of Iraq, the way that ISIS succeeded Al-Qaeda in 2012, 2013, and 2014 in eastern Syria and in western Iraq. So the vast majority of those forces, frankly, provide force protection for the other American forces for the small number of instructors who are there providing courses, helping planning, and in some cases helping to do intelligence analysis with the Iraqis. So the numbers we are talking about are very small. There is an impression in Iraq that there are large American bases all over Iraq. That's simply not true. American forces are all housed on Iraqi military facilities with much larger numbers of Iraqi forces. And this is really the story of the victory against ISIS as well. When the U.S. military came back in to help the fight against ISIS near the end of the summer of 2014, we did drop an awful lot of bombs from the air on ISIS targets, but on the ground, relatively few Americans took part in the fighting. It was more about helping to coordinate and train Iraqi forces to make the assaults and to come up with the battle plans that were needed to defeat ISIS. So there were, even at the height of the fight, we didn't have that many forces. I don't know the height of the forces, but it was far less than the 170. I'm thinking it's probably far, far less below that. But now the numbers are much, much smaller.
Let's go back to the maximum pressure campaign against Iran, because I think, as you noted in your kind of opening comments, that is really, in a lot of ways, the crux of the difference of the Trump administration and the Obama administration in regards to their engagement with Iraq. What does this maximum pressure campaign mean for Iraq, not just Iran? We know there are aspects of implementing sanctions that Iraq is constantly kind of being warned about, or there are discussions in the media about it may not complying with. We know there is this question about the U.S. military presence and putting tension on that, the roles of the PMUs, the kind of Iranian-backed militias now kind of incorporated in the state armed forces apparatus that are there. What does that sort of escalation of campaign and tension mean for Iraq practically in regards to its impact on its own policies?
Well, the first thing is to say that the maximum pressure campaign of the Trump administration is now being matched by a maximum resistance campaign by Tehran. Thus far, it has not had a significant impact on Iraq. It has the potential to do so, but it hasn't yet. The sanctions, for example, have been imposed upon countries that import oil from Iran. Iraq does not import any oil from Iran. And most of what goes back and forth across the Iraq-Iran border are fruits and vegetables, car parts, the things of everyday life, and the sizes are quite small. Our concern was that Iran would be able to bleed U.S. dollars or other hard currencies out of the Iraqi economy and make up for the shortage of petrodollars that they could not get when they could not sell their oil. The Iraqi government has been cooperating for several years very closely with the U.S. Treasury to make sure that there is no significant flow of U.S. dollars into Iran, and we are thus far pretty happy with their cooperation. We certainly would like to see the Iraqi government reduce its dependence economically on Iran. When I was in Baghdad, I had my staff try to do an analysis of Iran-Iraq bilateral trade to get a sense for what was going back and forth. And as I said, a lot of the trade is simply the normal stuff that goes back and forth across the border. There were two significant imports from Iran to Iraq, and that is one, electricity. Basra in the south of Iraq gets about 40% of its electricity from Iran, and a significant amount of natural gas, which is used in Iraq mostly to generate electricity in combined cycle power plants. So we have been arguing for several years that it makes sense for Iraq, which flares about 60% of its associated natural gas, to capture that gas, to use that gas in power generation, and to reduce their cost of power generation by not having to import electricity or gas from Iran, to become more energy self-sufficient. Unfortunately, I think the rhetoric of the maximum pressure campaign has redoubled the efforts of Tehran to make sure that Iraq does not, in fact, do that. And while it would have been fairly simple for the Iraqi government to sign a few contracts worth a few hundred million dollars with Western companies to quickly build facilities to capture that associated gas, it hasn't happened, I think largely because of strong pressure from Tehran. The role that the rhetoric of the maximum pressure campaign plays in that, I simply don't know. But it might have been easier without the heavy pressure on Iraq. What it does do, it reinforces that impression that I talked about earlier in the minds of Iraqis, that there is a competition between Iran and the United States for the soul of Iraq. And it has convinced the prime minister, among others, that neither side should win that fight, that there needs to be a balance between Iranian influence and American influence, and that Iraq has to keep its connections with both sides.
Now, in addition to the Trump administration's focus on Iran, this maximum pressure campaign, there is also another element that's cropped up in the U.S.-Iraqi relationship, and that is President Trump himself, who speaks off the cuff on a variety of issues, and Iraq is one that he has returned to from time to time. We've seen a few faux pas, whether it's comments about taking Iraqi oil during the campaign and very early in the administration, some discussions I mentioned before about U.S. troops in Iraq somehow doing activities surveilling Iran, doing something similar. And then the Christmas visit that you mentioned earlier was at least reported in the media as causing a bit of friction because the president was resistant to going to Baghdad to meet with any Iraqi officials, instead really only visited U.S. airbase and then departed. What impact do those sorts of faux pas have on the U.S.-Iraqi relationship? Are they taken seriously? Are they seen as the eccentricities of a head of state that is mitigated by effective diplomats like yourself? How do those sorts of little incidents, which get played up a great deal in the media, feed into the relationship?
I'll correct one thing that you said. The president didn't visit an American base in December. He visited an Iraqi base where there are U.S. forces.
Balad Air Base, I believe, right?
It was not Balad Air Base.
I'm sorry.
Al-Assad Air Base in Anbar. But I want to, again, underscore the idea that there are no U.S. bases in Iraq, that U.S. forces are there at the request of the Iraqi government, do everything that they do in coordination with the Iraqi government, and live on Iraqi facilities, except the small number that lives at the U.S. embassy. I think the statements that President Trump has made are more lost opportunities than anything else. He did not come to Baghdad and did not meet in person with any Iraqi officials when he came to Iraq in December of 2018. I think some of this was an inordinate focus on the security of the president and the first lady on the trip by Secret Service people who were much more focused on his safety than on the foreign policy that had to be conducted in the president's visit. We were able to arrange a very good phone conversation between the president and the prime minister while he was there, but we lost an opportunity to show him interacting with Iraqis, showing respect for Iraqi culture and Iraqi sovereignty by coming to Baghdad. We were simply unable to convince the Secret Service that it was safe enough for the president to come to Baghdad. On some of the other statements, I think that there is they have not had a significant impact on the relationship. And perhaps paradoxically, there is a certain amount of respect I have felt for President Trump as a leader who is like the leaders of the Middle East. He's a personality that many Iraqis can actually identify with from their own history and from their own politics. And they don't necessarily see anything odd or strange about what he does. From my standpoint, I think he passed up opportunities to do good things. But then again, I will say, as I did earlier, very early in his administration, he invited the Iraqi prime minister to the White House. He came in March of 2017. They had some very good meetings that I think set out a period of cooperation and understanding early in the administration that lasted for quite some time until the administration really got past the defeat of ISIS and started focusing more on the maximum pressure campaign on Iran and then refocused on Iraq with a slightly different frame looking at the region.
For the past few weeks, the United States and Iran have been in a situation where it looks like we're really on the edge of what could be a shooting war. Probably a large, small-scale one, probably a limited exchange of hostilities, but it's a possibility. We know President Trump authorized at least one set of strikes before calling them off against Iran. What would a conflict like that mean for the U.S.-Iraqi relationship? How would we expect the Iraqi government to respond, or would you expect the Iraqi government to respond and change or require to change its tack in the region? And similarly, what would it also mean for the U.S. military presence and diplomatic presence in Iraq?
First of all, I'd like to recharacterize your description of what has happened over the past couple of weeks. What I see is a very carefully choreographed dance between the United States and other Western countries and the Iranians. It's obvious to me that neither side wants a large conflict. A large conflict would not be good for Iran. A large conflict would certainly be expensive for the United States, the West, and possibly for those economies dependent upon the flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz. So what you have seen is the application of maximum pressure on Iran and the way in which the Iranian maximum resistance campaign is being implemented is a number of small, deniable attacks trying to put pressure on the United States indirectly. I thought at first that Iran was trying to get others to mediate between the United States and Iran, and I think that is still quite possible. Some of the statements that Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif made when he was in New York 2 weeks ago, the statement originally that Iran was willing to discuss ballistic missiles that was then quickly withdrawn, but a statement that was made to several press outlets that Iran was willing to accelerate the implementation of the JCPOA and the additional protocol, ratified in the Iranian parliament if the United States was willing to permanently lift sanctions, looked to me very much like the opening proposal in a negotiation. I think that, frankly, Zarif is trying to be able to define for this administration a better deal that Trump can get beyond what the JCPOA accomplished while at the same time, Zarif and the Iranian government seems to be trying to avoid anything that is going to constrain the activities of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, the Al-Quds Force, the part of the Iranian government that has conducted destabilizing, you know, revolutionary activities, support for insurgent groups in the region. So I'll even say this past week, my institute, the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, did a piece that described the relations between the United States and Iran as on knife's edge, poised between compromise or conflict, with, for the time being, everybody seemingly quite comfortable to be perched on the edge of the knife. And what I'm concerned about is not a conscious decision by either Washington or Tehran to go to conflict, but by a mistake, an overzealous commander, someone particularly in the Iranian Revolutionary Guards or in one of the militias associated with Iran, whether in Iraq or in Yemen, in Syria, in Lebanon, doing something that goes outside the bounds of what Iran wants to do right now, but that could spark a conflict. So I don't see either the U.S. government or the Iranian government seeking a conflict. In fact, I see them trying to pressure the other but stay short of a shooting war. The danger is always that something will happen that will change that equation and make it politically or emotionally necessary for one of the sides to go to war. In Iraq, there are probably two possible outcomes for this. One is, should the flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz be cut, that means that most of Iraq's oil production will be bottled up inside the Gulf. And I think something over 80% of the revenue that Iraq gets from oil production won't get to market. The amount of oil that goes north through Kurdistan, through Turkish ports into the Mediterranean is quite small, and there are no operational pipelines from the south to the north to divert that flow for Iraq. So it could hurt Iraq's economy significantly. Interesting that the Iranians last week also mentioned in the press that they would not target the flow of Iraqi oil out of the Strait of Hormuz. The other thing that concerns me as and for my colleagues in Iraq is that there are, as you mentioned, militias, many of which predate the rise of ISIS in Iraq, trained and supported and in many cases directed by the government of Iran or by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, that are putting greater pressure on the United States to leave Iraq. Their stated purpose is to get U.S. military personnel out. It's really hard to conduct attacks against U.S. military personnel because these militias would have to attack Iraqi bases and potentially incur Iraqi casualties in an attack on American forces. It would be easier to go after our embassy in Baghdad or our consulate in Erbil, where you can be much more assured that you will be targeting Americans and not targeting others. This is what I fear, is that some group, probably one that is not directly under the control of Iran, might feel that they want to make a name for themselves by being the one that pushes the Americans out by increasing casualties. And that's one of the fears that I see in Iraq. Otherwise, I suspect that there will be a further entrenching in the population of this attitude that neither the United States nor Iran really has Iraq's interests at heart, and we are just fighting over Iraq, not to the benefit of Iraqis, and I would not like to see that continue.
Well, precisely because of this knife's edge posture that we've seen prevailing in the region, we've seen the State Department take a few steps to adjust our diplomatic presence. Really, it started actually back in last fall when we saw the Consulate General in Basra be shut down. I don't believe ever reopened after that initial pullback. And then more recently, in I believe May of this year, we saw non-essential personnel removed from the embassy in Baghdad. I don't believe they've gone back. I'm not 100% positive, or at least I know staffing levels are kept low. And there were some media reports, at least, that the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, is interested in keeping staffing levels at that far reduced level, at that kind of non-essential personnel level, although I don't know if that means the same personnel profile or not. What is your sort of reaction to that sort of posture? I mean, the security threat no doubt is real. Iraq has never been an easy environment for diplomats to operate, and that's been true for many years, although it may be harder now in certain ways because of this tension with Iran. But what does that mean for our ability to operate in Iraq, to engage diplomatically, and for the range of national interests we really want to pursue with the Iraqis?
That's a very good question, and it's frankly a question I have asked of many in the Iraqi government over the course of the past year before I left. I often made the point that there are very few countries in the world where people plant bombs and shoot missiles at diplomatic facilities to send a political message, and that it is no longer acceptable to do this in Iraq, and that it was the responsibility of the government of Iraq to prevent this from happening and to fulfill their international responsibilities and protect American military personnel and American diplomatic personnel who are in the country under the Vienna Convention or at the request of the Iraqi government. So that's where we started the conversations with the Iraqi government. The statements that Prime Minister Abdel Mahdi made last month, where he criticized some of the Popular Mobilization Forces units that had publicly and privately threatened the American presence, is a step in the right direction. But the Iraqis have not yet made as many concrete steps as they need to make sure that those units remain under the control of the government of Iraq and not under the control of Iran or under no one's control but their own leader. Back to the original question, that means there is a real threat against U.S. personnel, diplomatic and military, in Iraq. And I know that Secretary Pompeo, especially based on some of what he said in the hearings covering Benghazi when he was a member of Congress, believes that it is the personal responsibility of the Secretary of State to protect U.S. diplomatic facilities and personnel. And I think he has taken that very personally and has directed a number of changes. It is certainly well within his purview and responsibilities as Secretary of State to do that. I don't know precisely what the laydown of the mission is right now because we had begun planning for a drawdown before I left, but the plans accelerated and changed after I departed. What I will say is that the model for our diplomatic facilities in Iraq is too big. They are not sustainable. You have been there. You know the resources that are required to maintain these very large compounds. Most of the personnel at our embassies are not American diplomats. They are contract personnel who provide security, who provide food and water, who keep the facilities actually running. And no matter how many people we withdraw, we still have to have a certain large number to keep the facilities going. This is a question that's going to have to be addressed at some point, but it will need to be addressed with probably significant investments of money to rejigger the facilities so that they are more sustainable in the long run. I think that withdrawing significant numbers of diplomatic personnel from Iraq does reduce our presence. It means that there are fewer American diplomats on the roads going out and talking to Iraqis. But again, that cuts both ways. If we have fewer diplomats out meeting with Iraqis, that means we talk to fewer members of parliament. That means that we have fewer officers to help American companies finalize deals with the Iraqi government or Iraqi companies. There are fewer American diplomats who are out there telling America's story through social media, through print media, on television, on radio. And we will probably have to retrench a bit and focus on those parts of the relationship which the administration believes is most important. Hopefully, at some point in the near future, the threat can be demonstrated to have gotten lower, and we can restore some of those. But again, I think, and I'm sure that Secretary Pompeo was aware of this, reducing diplomatic personnel reduces what we are able to do at a mission. When you were there with me many years ago, the mission was more than twice as large as it was when I left. It's now been reduced again. The people who are there, Ambassador Matt Tuller, who just arrived about a month and a half ago, will have to work with the administration to refocus what his remaining staff does and make sure that it is addressing the core concerns of the president and the secretary of state and the administration. So you have good diplomats who will make that happen. We will probably not be able to do everything that we did when I had a larger staff last year and in previous years.
So in departing from this post, not just from this post really, but also from your prior ambassadorship in Kuwait and from a long career in the diplomatic corps, what sort of advice would you give or did you give to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, to the administration, and to, you know, future administrations that might be coming after the Trump administration, whether that's in 2 years or 4 years or 6 years from now? What advice would you give them about how to engage with the Iraqi government and the future of the U.S.-Iraqi relationship?
Well, first of all, one thing that I did in fact tell everyone is that a continued American relationship, strong relationship, and presence in Iraq is important to help stabilize the region, so that we should not disengage from Iraq. And as I said earlier, I don't think that President Trump wants to disengage from Iraq. Secondly, I believe the United States needs to use the power and influence of all of our allies, of the United Nations and of other international actors, be they non-governmental or corporate, to help us achieve our goals. And I don't believe that this administration is doing that as much as it should. I'd like to see us working more closely with Europe, especially with Great Britain and other countries that have very similar interests in Iraq turning out well. And I would recommend that this administration do more to bring our allies into Iraq policy.
Now, of course, you are no longer an Iraq-focused expert or policymaker. You now have a little bit of a broader purview in your new role at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. What other issues do people who look at the region, who think about policy, who are impacted by the policies from the region, what should we be thinking about looking forward from this new perch, looking at the region a little bit more broadly?
I'm really enjoying my new responsibilities because I am much more of a thinker and less of a doer in this job, and I get to look at the world from 30,000 feet a lot more often. There are a couple of things which apply in Iraq, but which also apply in the rest of the Gulf region, which I think are actually quite important, that probably a lot of Americans and a lot of American policymakers haven't begun to wrestle with. First are demographic issues. In Iraq, in Saudi Arabia, in Oman, there are large numbers of young citizens who are well-educated but don't have the economic opportunities that they want. This is potentially a recipe for instability, particularly in Iraq. In some other countries like the United Arab Emirates and Qatar, a very large part of the population, over 80%, are expatriates, where many of the citizens feel they're losing control of their countries and the country's culture, and that is an issue that those governments will have to address. More broadly, though, is the very basic social contract between the citizen and the government in Iraq and in the Gulf. And it is essentially the social contract of a rentier state. Governments believe that they should extract resources from the ground, which they can do easily and cheaply, sell the proceeds of hydrocarbons, and then provide to the citizens. And most citizens believe that this is the responsibility of government. So in Iraq, in particular, but also in Oman and Saudi Arabia, where you have a large and growing population of youth, many of them believe that it is the government's responsibility to educate them, provide them health care, provide them jobs. And if the governments are unable to do this, again, it's a problem of stability. But maybe the biggest thing in my mind is the potential of a strategic and philosophical shift in the way that the Gulf sees the world. The significantly increased production of oil and gas in Canada and the United States through fracking has had a major impact on international energy markets. And the United States, and to a somewhat less extent Europe, are far less dependent upon the Gulf than we were just 10 years ago, and certainly not as we were when I was a kid in the 1970s. Instead, the markets for Gulf oil and gas have shifted to the east. The big markets are China, Japan, South Korea, India, and Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam. The Gulf countries in particular, their muscle memory for policy, their muscle memory for security issues is still to go with an American option or at least a Western option. They still prefer American companies. They prefer the philosophy of the way that Americans and Westerners do things. But I fear that as they are more dependent upon Chinese and Japanese and Indian petrodollars to maintain their economies, those political ties with the United States are going to weaken. And my ultimate fear is that in 10 years or 20 years, young Saudis will no longer see democracy and an open society as the best way to move. They will start to see a Chinese model of development, a top-down, centrally directed, quasi-free market system as being preferable, especially those in government who will want to develop the economy, provide for their populations while they maintain political control. And this, in 20 years, is what I'm concerned about. And I think that policymakers ought to think a little bit more about what the United States can do to arrest that trend, even as the Gulf sells most of its oil and gas to Asia.
Well, hopefully we can have you back in another time to do another podcast about that topic. But until then, Ambassador Doug Silliman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Scott, thank you very much. It was very good to see you here in Washington.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to leave us a rating and review wherever you are listening. And be sure to visit our online store at www.thelawfarestore.com for Lawfare mugs, t-shirts, onesies, and challenge coins. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.